dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Over the past few weeks, we've heard how the way of life of communities and the health of ecosystems are destroyed by multinational energy corporations that come in to extract profits and leave, whether they're dynamiting mountains in West Virginia or poisoning the rainforests of Ecuador. And we've heard how this impacts, as well as implicates, all of us living on the blue planet. This week's program contains information that is particularly critical to local listeners in the Finger Lakes, as it deals with a threat now posed by an alliance of energy corporations and corrupt New York State officials who are in league to turn our beloved home into a poisoned industrial wasteland through gas drilling. And we're also going to hear how our communities are organizing to fight back, to preserve our way of life. You've perhaps heard how natural gas is clean energy, not at the site of extraction. Because this show is heard all over the U.S. and beyond, I want to give out-of-town listeners a sense of this place that I love so much. There are many beautiful places all over this planet, but I am sure that the Finger Lakes region of New York State is a match for any of them. It's not because of any extreme or singular feature, but because everything is just right. It greatly resembles the land of the Shire, the fictional home of Tolkien's hobbits, but its magic is real. I'm not the only person around here who's made that comparison. According to the website of the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, assigned by Albany to preside over the destruction of the Finger Lakes region, there are about 8,896 miles of rivers and streams and over 400 lakes and ponds. There are also more than 1,000 waterfalls where the water emerges from deep gorges that cleave craggy wooded hillsides. It's a place of small farms and small towns, where strangers stop to help you pull your car out of a ditch. And like the fictional Shire, it has its share of foolish hobbits and greedy hobbits, as well as those who hunt mushrooms in the woods and fields. 7 million people come here each year to enjoy the peace, the water, the woods, and the excellent wine that is grown and made here. I'm one of the lucky ones. I don't have to work and save all year just to come here for a couple of weeks. I live here. We're not just a tourist destination, however. We're a place full of people actively striving for a new vision of a sustainable human society. We have more solar power installed per capita than anywhere in New York State, and the number of community-supported organic family farms in the area is growing. Every year, new farmers' markets start up in the region, and we're a center for the practice and study of permaculture and sustainable agriculture in the Northeast. We are a place where the word community still means something, and that's getting rarer in strip-mallized America. On occasion, I get emails from listeners who ask how they can contribute money to me personally in support of this program. Thank you, but this program is a gift, my attempt to make a contribution to make this world better. If you want to give something back to me, then do everything in your power to save the Shire. Later in the broadcast, I'll be giving you some educational websites of organizations that I know are in great need of your support in this effort. What we're going to hear on the program this week is a forum held to inform and organize the community on the topic of gas drilling. Many people in the area have been misled on the situation we face. Gas wells have been drilled in the region for decades, and many people erroneously assume that this latest gas drilling project is more of the same. Not so. This is a project to retrieve gas from deeply buried shale, a high-impact process utilizing toxic chemicals, using and contaminating billions of gallons of water, and placing extensive, obtrusive, and virtually permanent industrial infrastructure in the landscape. The presentation included images, which I can't show you on radio, of the landscapes already blighted elsewhere in the quest to wring gas from shale through a process patented by Halliburton. The forum was sponsored by a local community group, the Finger Lakes Progressives, and was held January 10, 2009, in Montour Falls, New York. I apologize in advance for some technical issues. The small room was crowded and noisy and without a PA system, and my recording disc, I later discovered, had some bad sectors, so I've had to voice over part of the presentation. I'm going to suspend the readings from Power and Powerlessness for this week, though the material is absolutely relevant to the topic. But I'll make up for it with a good long reading next week. So here's event organizer Kate Bartholomew to introduce the speakers.
For our first speaker today, I'd like to introduce Chris Berger. He is a former Broome County legislator. He is chair of the Binghamton Regional Sustainability Coalition. He's on the Zero Waste Committee nationally for the Sierra Club and is the chair of the Zero Waste Committee for the state chapter, the Atlantic chapter of the Sierra Club. And he's an adjunct professor at SUNY Binghamton. And he is going to give us an overview of the Marcellus Shale play and some more information. Chris.
Okay, well, thank you very much for having me. I always know this progressive people are a tough group, and they're coming out on such dire warnings of weather and so forth. But I'm certainly glad you're here, and I'm glad to be here. This is becoming a tougher issue to talk about or to give a talk on as we go along, because everybody seems to be has different levels of knowledge of what this is all about. So I've been assigned to kind of give an overview, and that's what I'll do in fairly rapid order. So, but if you have any questions and I'm going too fast, let me know. But this is going to be pretty basic, but we'll go through it pretty fast. certainly, if you don't know what shale is, it's basically, and this particular shale deposit that we're talking about was formed in the Devonian period. It was formed with rich vegetation that existed at the time. It dies, mixes with sediment in very shallow seas that existed at the time, and they decay, and that's really what forms natural gas. The process, if you don't know the science, it's called carbon sequestering, and that is basically the plants sequester carbon. Back then, there was a very high carbon dioxide atmosphere, quite frankly. And it took millions of years. And this is important because this is kind of the big picture context in which we're operating in. This is a process that took millions of years to sequester this carbon, basically made the atmosphere and the Earth habitable for higher life forms. And just keep in the back of your mind that this is really applies to really all fossil fuels. We're in a very short period of time reversing that process. Just keep that in mind. So it's a process that basically changed our Earth from what it existed back in the Devonian period to a planet hospitable for higher life forms. The shale deposit itself, as you can see, covers a pretty big area, and it's not the center of it, but we're actually in what they call the sweet spot of this. It's the deepest part of the deposit, and is estimated to have the most natural gas sitting right under us. Estimated to be 500 trillion cubic feet of natural gas at present levels of technology. About 10% of that, or 5 trillion cubic feet, could be recovered. Just to put that in perspective, the U.S. consumes about 25 trillion cubic feet of natural gas per year. So here's another big picture context in which to think about this. We're basically going through all this process. We're basically about 2 years worth of consumption, typical consumption. Okay. Briefly, what's entailed in getting at this natural gas? The deposit, as you can see, is actually a relatively deep deposit as shale formations go, and always known to be there, but before higher prices in natural gas and newer technologies, it was pretty much inaccessible. But now, well, now that the prices have gone down, we actually have a little bit of breathing room because I think the whole process is going to slow down for a variety of reasons, and certainly the drop in natural gas prices is one of them. But it's going to come back up again. This issue is not going to go away, I assure you. What do you do to access that? First off is an access road. They build access roads. They then build a pad approximately 3 to 5 acres in size. They build what they call mud ponds. They're basically plastic-lined holes in the ground, if you will, where the dregs of the drilling process are brought up and stored, some of which is volatilized, just given off into the air, but a lot of it's trucked away. What is not shown here is typically they put in another, they make another pond to store water, because this is a highly intensive, this is a process that uses a lot of water. The drill rig itself, of course, and then the drilling goes down through multiple layers, one of which, of course, is our aquifers. Now, they do try to protect the aquifer in a certain way, and I'll go into this in more detail in a little bit, but there is some attempts to protect the aquifer. And then when they get down into the deposit itself, and this is the new technology. Typical drilling in the past has been basically vertical drilling down into the deposit, and you pull out the oil and or gas. The new technology is what they call horizontal drilling, and that as you can see, it involves basically going 90 degrees so that the drilling process goes horizontal, and then they do what they call fracking from there, which is through some small charges that are placed there to basically break open the shale, as well as using certain what they call frack fluids, and I'll go into that in a little more detail in a bit, but this is a process that basically fractures the shale, opens it up so that the gas can migrate into the pipes and be brought up. So the other part of the process is, of course, is creating a network of collection pipes. So that, in a nutshell, is what the process... Oh, and then also compressors, very, very key. And I'll get back to that in a bit. Okay, so first they bring in the equipment. And this is like big equipment, really big equipment. So much so as most of our rural roads, quite frankly, are just incapable. They're going to butcher these roads. Here's a picture here. And as you can see, even the truck itself is not going at its own under its own steam. They need a bulldozer to pull it through. This is obviously dirt roads, but a lot of our area is dirt roads, and they'll be building access roads, but they'll also be using our roads as well. Here's another picture. There's the equipment being pulled up the hill, and this is obviously a public road because you can see the roadside there. So this is what we can expect the equipment to do to our roads. The site, like I said, 3 to 5 acres size. Another vision of it. Site preparation. The truck traffic, 45 pieces of equipment truck, 600 water trucks, and then because you can't transport the wastewater in the same trucks that you bring fresh water in, you're going to have 700 more trucks taking the wastewater away from the site. Just a lot of trucks. let's leave it at that.
I have a question.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that all of that equipment for just one site?
Just one site.
Not for a network of sites.
No.
And actually, if you have multiple wells from a pad, you're going to have that much traffic coming for each of those wells. And you could have a dozen or more.
Gas is valuable.
So once one of these sites is established, how long does it run before it's, in quotes, empty, if we're talking about just 2 years?
The amount of...
Maybe we could, try to hold some questions until the end, because we've got four, we're going to have a question and answer session at the end. So if you, obviously if it's, write it down and... to remember the question, because we want to make sure we get through everybody and have time for a lot of interaction at the end. Sorry.
Okay. I'll defer to her. I like to take questions, but that's okay.
Oh, well, maybe one or two, but,
Okay. Anyway, here's another view of the site, and as you can see, these are all the tanker trucks queuing up to get to the site. And here's another little thing, out west, of course, the land is a lot flatter. Here, it's a lot more hilly terrain. So what they'll be doing is terracing, and this actually is a good picture that shows that. I mean, here's the ponds here, and here's the water storage pond here. And here, like I say, is all the tankers and all the diesel fumes and the like that will contribute to our atmosphere. Okay. Mud ponds, as I mentioned, basically you dig a hole, line it with plastic, and that's what they consider okay to create this pond. And then the drilling begins. Here's a nice little farm area. Hopefully this is the guy that leased the land and it's not the neighbor of the guy who leased the land. Because here again, you got the drag pond, the drilling site itself, the storage area. It's a major activity. Let's leave it at that. 24/7, except for Christmas. 3 to 4 months. To get this up and running. But then, thankfully, it does decrease in terms of activity. They try to clean up the site. They'll, like, reseed it, a lot of it. What you're basically left in is a smaller area that's fenced in. And what they leave, they cap off the drill head with what they call a Christmas tree, some idea of a sick joke, I think. And then what you're left with is that plus compressors. And these aren't like your little household compressors. These are like, this is a fence. So it gives you like probably an 8-foot fence. So you can see the size of the compressors that we're dealing with. They try to put mufflers on it. But this is what you're living with for the life of the of the.
So those compressors are like 25 feet tall?
Yeah, about 20 feet. Thanks. 15, 20 feet high. Thank you.
I'm sorry to ask a question. I know you don't want it. But I don't see any of that stuff around here, those big things. I haven't noticed them.
Yeah, this is different technology.
This is for the Marcellus?
Yes. That's why they put a whole halt on the whole thing, because now they've stepped back and they're studying this. But, yeah, don't compare what you might have seen in the past. This is a new animal. Okay, so and this, they're operated on diesel, and so just keep in mind this is diesel fuel, and this is what you're living with for the life of the project. Okay, then like I mentioned, pipeline connectors. It'll most of it will feed in probably to the Millennium Pipeline. You may be familiar with that project. Okay, so what's a fully developed gas field look like, and what does it do to our landscape? Well, this is pretty much what it does to the landscape. Though this is actually out west, so as you move further east, it gets even more horrendous, unfortunately. All these are sites.
Where?
This is not a like a housing development.
Is this Wyoming or Colorado?
This is certainly moving east. This is probably down in Pennsylvania. From the air. And again, this is not a housing development. This is a fully developed field. And remember, it's the sites and the connector lines, the network of connector lines. Okay. Lifespan, about 30 to 50 years, and they found that they have to come in every 10 years, or every 5 years, I'm sorry, on average, to redrill. It tends to kind of block up over time. And so in 5 years' time, you'll basically have all that drilling happening again. Okay, how do people typically respond to this? Well, basically, I figured one in three ways. They oppose the gas drilling, they support the gas drilling, or they could possibly support the gas drilling with stipulations and safeguards. It kind of probably covers the waterfront and how people respond to it. All aggravated by the fact that in any particular community, the costs and risks are pretty evenly distributed, where the benefits are unequally distributed. Works too well with community building. Okay, so what are the gas opponents? Basically, certainly, there's a class of people that I would call preservationists. They value the peace and tranquility of the area. That's why they moved into the area oftentimes. They value the beauty of the area. They're concerned about the destruction of the way of life, like I was alluding to earlier. They practice land ethics, like a lot of the old farmers. And they're concerned about the destruction of the community. This is not a good way of building neighbors. In fact, it's probably a good way to get your neighbors mad at you. People who bought property that was zoned residential, thinking that they were protected, this trumps any land use planning. Just keep that in mind. That's out the window. They may have, many have small plots of land and will receive very little or nothing from the royalties, but would be impacted just the same. Okay. Some even more so. That's a detail I may get into later. And then there's some environmentalists who are concerned about the health effects, short and long term. They're concerned about habitat destruction. They're concerned about threats to biodiversity and the like. And a lot of the gas drilling opponents ask this basic question: why are we butchering our land to extract fossil fuels that release carbon sequestered over millions of years, sequestering that has made the plantable habitable to begin with? Good question. Okay, gas drilling supporters, who might they be? Certainly investment, people, that's why they have the land as an investment. This is a good return. This is a good return on their investment. Absentee landowners. I don't know how much is around here. Certainly in Broome County, there's a lot of absentee landowners. They bought the land thinking to retire here. Well, you know, this is a good way to, like, cash in and then find some other place to retire to. They certainly support this. Landowners who are basically unaware of the consequences, and unfortunately there's too many of those still out there. Landowners who know the impacts sign the lease and leave the area. And believe me, they're out. I've been in conversations with some of these people. They say, who basically say, you know, I'd be stupid to not take this deal. I can just take that money and leave and find some other place to live. And that's their attitude. The next one is much more difficult to deal with, and something that I think everybody we should at least be sensitive to. The people are struggling. They've been hanging on to the land, especially small farmers. You know, it's a tough business, and they're struggling. And this is maybe the only way they're going to be able to hang on to their land. Okay, so, and there are people in that position. Here's a new one that I've added. Somebody in the talk just raised the point and it became obvious. There's a lot of people out there, they look at the energy. This is, we need the energy, we got to do this. These users who are unaware or don't have to live with the consequences of the action. It's kind of a mirror that we really all need to be looking in and asking ourselves, you know, what are, because this is a lifestyle that we've basically developed for ourselves, a high energy use lifestyle. And there's, of course, there's some government leaders who only see short-term consequences. We don't know any government leaders fitting that bill. Okay. Anyway. Gas supporters. And then there's that group that support drilling, but with stipulations and safeguards. Who might they be? Well, there are environmentalists who do believe that if developed and implemented responsibly, that regulations can protect us. We can do this. People who see benefits but want long-term viability of the area protected. They are concerned about landowners' rights protected. They want liability reduced. They want landowners equitably compensated. And then government leaders who want protection of the health and welfare of their constituents and adequate compensation for the stress on the infrastructure. It's a big concern for municipal leaders. And they see this as economic development, but they want to preserve the long-term community viability. Okay, briefly, because I know there's other people who will be talking about these issues as well, but we certainly have water issues. Concern about where that water, all that water that's going to be used in the process, where is it going to come from, how much at one time. Each, like I say, each well requires about 5 to 6 million gallons to drill. Right? It undermines our flood mitigation strategies. Whenever you have cleared land, that reduces the water retention capacity of that land. And there's a significant amount of land that's going to be cleared for building the drill to set up the process, and then all the connection pipes and so forth. A significant amount of land that's basically cleared and loses that water retention right. It's going to affect our flood mitigation strategies. Stress on water treatment facilities. That's a whole issue in and of itself. We'll probably get into that in a deeper way later. And the big one, of course, groundwater contamination can be a problem for many, many years if indeed that becomes polluted. This is a lot of detailed stuff that I don't think we have the time, but certainly the gas companies aren't stupid. They do try to protect the groundwater. There's technology out there that does attempt to do that. It basically involves casing as it goes through the groundwater, but we know that those mitigation measures can fail. There is problems associated with it. And maybe we can go into this in more detail in a bit. Just keep in mind, encasement systems are designed to reduce the probability of contamination but cannot eliminate the possibility. Bottom line. There's attempt to protect the aquifer with the mud ponds. Like I said, they don't they line the ponds with plastic. Is that enough? Most of us feel not, because those plastic liners can be punctured if it's not seamed right. If it's in a floodplain and we happen to have a flood at the time that this activity is going on, it just becomes mixed with the floodwaters. There's a variety of ways that things that can go wrong when you have open pit for the drilling rigs, like is typically practiced. And then this new technology, and that is the fracking, the horizontal fracking. There's a certain school of thought that suggests that this in of itself provides pathways, or could provide pathways for contamination. So it weighs down, so you know, I won't say one way or the other whether this is a real threat or not. Well, actually, that's why we're having a whole environmental impact statement, hopefully to look at that. Okay, well, what are in those drilling rigs? Certainly the mud made up of clay and ground stone. There are metals. We know underneath in our ground we have cadmium, arsenic, lead, and mercury. Sulfuric acid, hydrogen sulfide, NORM, natural occurring radioactive materials, brine, of course, and these frac fluids, which are unknown at this point, what those frac fluids contain. And then there's unknowns in the ground layers themselves. We have a pretty good idea, but we don't know for sure everything that's down there. Okay, hydrofracking chemicals. We'll look at those in more detail later. Natural gas has its own contaminations. Actually, we might hope that there's hydrogen sulfide in it, because as some of you may know, actually natural gas itself is odorless. So they actually add odor to natural gas so people know that if there's a leak in their homes. Now, if you have natural gas without any hydrogen sulfide in it, for instance, it could be there and you wouldn't know it until it hit a flame. And then it'd be too late. Okay, here's like water contamination. Somebody's been able to light their I don't think water typically does this. Pollution, dust and dirt, certainly from the process itself, but ongoing with the compressors and the wellhead servicing, the ambient air quality, measured to be equivalent to a good-sized city when all is up and running. noise, certainly through the drilling process, horrendous noise. Most people are very surprised in how much noise that process entails. But then also the ongoing noise of the compressors. That's what you're really living with day in, day out for a long period of time. The impact on the infrastructure, accidents associated with gas drilling. There's certainly chemical fires, gas eruptions, release of radioactive elements, contamination of aquifers, stress on the emergency services, probably in this area, much like most of Broome County, volunteer emergency services at that with no training. Blowouts, they can have and will occur. I think that's the reality of it. This is a little interesting side. This is probably worst case scenario. It is worst case scenario, probably. We could say that for sure. Happened out in Turkmenistan. Yes. Caved in. There was a cavern underneath. They didn't know it. I think they actually turned it on. They lit it because otherwise, just you'd have a lot of hydrocarbons escaping. It's been burning since the mid '70s, and that's a 60 meter. Oops, sorry. That's a 60 meter. I mean, these are people. They've turned it into a tourist attraction. But worst case scenario, it really is. Though we shouldn't have a lot of, we shouldn't feel too proud because actually down in Pennsylvania, you may be aware that we actually set off an underground fire in a coal vein that basically required a whole community to be moved. So accidents do happen. Okay, estimate economic benefit. This is the figures from D.C. So there is some economic benefit, but the economic impacts, threat to landscape tourism, except when we could have that Keats from Hell. All else fails. This is a beautiful place to live and work. I mean, I'm kind of biased in that respect, but I really do believe that, and this is going to significantly impact that. Threats to agriculture, hunting. This basically kills hunting. You're not going to be able to hunt anywhere near these. You wouldn't want to have people hunting near these sites, and it pretty much kills the hunting of the area. Threats to land value, long-term anyway. Higher infrastructure costs, which translates into higher taxes, threats to attracting young people. Would people want to live here after this occurs? The impact on the infrastructure, like I said, even our paved roads will be impacted. The bridges, certainly rural area bridges, aren't built for this type of traffic. It's going to be a big issue. Regulation, which I think we're going to get into, or why some people don't trust their government to protect them. Basically, all this has been exempt from the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and the stormwater rules, Safe Water Drinking Act. They've got exemptions to all these pieces of legislation. They must have friends in high places. Halliburton is the, I say that because Halliburton is a big owner of the hydrofracking rights. But it's not just at the federal level. We have state level. State has also passed, like I mentioned earlier, laws that enable D.C. to overrule home rule in any zoning. And they've recently passed a law to force landowners to become part of what they call spacing units, whether the landowner wants to or not. It's called compulsory integration.
What does that
mean? Basically, if you're within what they map out spacing units that a company will control, and that's where and they can build, they can have their drill sites, and if they have control over 60% of the land 60% of the land or land owners, basically land, it doesn't matter really how much owners, but if they have control over 60% of the land, they can force the other 40% to integrate into that. So there's a lot of things the state has done also that kind of gets people a little nervous and whether they're really going to protect our rights or not. So this is what we are going to go into. Other people are going to go, I think Adam's going to go into
Might save this for Q&A because I'm not feeling really...
I mean, certainly a number of us have been doing... And actually, when I've spoken to groups, I kind of use that typically as an opportunity to brainstorm. If there are things that are not on this list we haven't thought of, these are ways, mitigation measures that we think would improve the process. Of course, that automatically assumes that... It could, at the end of the day, be made safe. But these are certainly things we'd want to see if we're to be convinced that it's going to be safe at all. So, and we'll deal with that in a lot more detail later on. So, bottom line, if we're going to do it, we need to be concerned about the long-term viability and sustainability of the area. So that's where BRSC is now, and maybe Adam can go into that in more detail.
That was Chris Berger, former Broome County legislator, an adjunct professor at SUNY Binghamton, and an organizer with the Binghamton Regional Sustainability Coalition.
Maybe while Adam's setting up, if people have quick questions that I might be able to address.
Yeah, the fracking fluid ponds.
Yeah.
Who's supposed to clean that mess up after the fact?
Well, the companies themselves are supposed to clean it up. DEC is supposed to make sure they clean it up.
And wildlife getting into them, this should be...
Well, they are fenced off.
From birds?
From birds. No, not from birds. And actually, there is a concern, actually, if we do indeed go to the open pit, which is what they practice down in Pennsylvania. I mean, there's some of us that are... pushing for what they call closed pit or tanks for that. But if the open pits are used, then that's a chance for evaporation, and so there's a lot of issues related to that.
Who is monitoring all of this as workers? The government is allowing it. It's government workers, so they're not hiring them. I mean, you have to have a lot of people monitor to see if this is going.
Yeah, and that indeed is an issue, especially, I don't know if people have been following the budget process, but DC's budget has actually been cut.
Yes.
So we felt that they really didn't have enough of a monitoring system in place even prior to those cuts. So that is going to be an issue. Now, to DEC's credit, at least this is what they've said. They said they're not going to grant permits for anything more than they can keep their eyes on. That's it. I'm just quoting what the DEC's...
I want to know who creates these species.
It's the companies working through landmen. Visiting landowners.
Well, there's also a state law, too, that's just recently been passed that mandates in footage between these wellheads, which has been reduced from, I think, 640 feet down to 400 feet. That was just passed here last year.
Reduced by whom?
Reduced by the state legislature.
State legislature.
They passed on passing.
And then they reduced.
Right.
Okay.
We're going to move on now. Please hold your questions until later on, and we're going to run over substantially on our two-hour allotment here. I'd like to introduce somebody who we're switching a little bit in the orientation, someone who's actually living with the gas well. Also, there's a proposal to store some of the Trenton Black River brine in this abandoned gas well. It's called the Malula gas well down in the Van Etten Spencer area. She's a young woman who is a farmer, founded her a business, which is a Eve Cidery and Winery. And this is her first time being activated, becoming an activist within her own community. I'd like you to welcome Autumn Stochek from Van Etten area.
Really nervous about public speaking. We're not the public. Okay, I'm going to be a little bit different here from what Chris was talking about. I think he had a middle section there in his presentation that was about where you fall and what camp you are in the gas drilling issue. See if you can figure out which camp I'm in here. Actually, I don't know how much you folks are all aware of how much gas drilling is already going on in this area. In my town, and just south of Watkins, actually, and a huge part of Chemung County, there's been a lot of development in the past 8 years with horizontal drilling, not hydrofracking, but horizontal drilling, which is a newish technology and has yielded a lot more gas and has drawn multinational energy corporations into this area. And that's basically what happened in our town. In 1999, my parents signed a lease on their farm. And this is just as they had always done since the 70s when they moved to the area. They, it wasn't for the money, they signed for about $2 an acre. And it was kind of like a neighborly thing to do. Actually, our neighbor would go around with a local drilling company from Pennsylvania and have coffee at your kitchen table and shoot the breeze and sign the lease. And it was completely inconsequential, so much so that my parents never mentioned it to me. And it only came up a few years after that when I was talking about my business partner signing a lease on his orchard for $50 an acre. Once again, we thought it was inconsequential. However, in 2005, Fortuna Energy Company bought the lease from the local drilling company. And Fortuna Energy is a subsidiary of Talisman Energy Company, a multinational energy corporation based out of Canada, which operates in the North Sea, Peruvian Amazon. They were operating in Sudan as part of that whole ordeal over there. I think it was a huge surprise for my family when we found out that they wanted to drill a well on our property. And we got together. We scrambled to find any lawyer that wouldn't just laugh at us, because at this time people said, "They don't drill around here. Don't worry about it. It's not a big deal." And so we went to talk to Chris Denton, who was the only lawyer that really took us seriously, and he combed over the lease. But I think he didn't really see any way to get out of it, and there wasn't really royalty checks to be made or royalty percentages to be made on people who were getting out of a lease, so it kind of didn't go anywhere. So my family tried to make the best of the situation. We negotiated with Fortuna with whatever leverage we had remaining. We put environmental safeguards into our lease. We wrote a surface agreement. I think that our well may be the only well in Van Etten where the drilling muds weren't simply folded over and buried, which is common practice with drilling. And I think we really gave it our best shot. We trusted Fortuna at the time and believed the assurances that they made to us that they're a company that's really concerned about the environment and just made the best of it. Anyway, I'm not even going to go into all the details about what it was like to deal with Fortuna. I think it was pretty much a full-time job for my mom for 2 years while they were drilling. They had to be watched constantly. It turned out they pretty much lived up to every cliche you might have of a multinational energy corporation who is profit-driven. It seemed like every assurance we had been given and at times tricked or pressured into believing was ignored. In fact, much of the surface lease that was a written and legally binding document was ignored, and essentially it came down to them basically saying, "We're not going to do it, and if you don't like it, sue us." And we felt powerless. Let's see, the Stochek well was actually, it's a name, interestingly, my family's achieved a sort of notoriety in our area because the Stoshek well in 2005 was the highest yielding gas well in the history of gas drilling in New York State. Everybody heard all about the Stosheks. Even at 12.5% royalties, which was the low rate that my parents had signed a lease at, they received a lot of money. They were able to put solar panels on their house, build a small addition, and buy a tractor. It wasn't enough money to make them rich or retire, but it was certainly more than they'd ever had in their pockets at one time. Sadly, I think now they've come to view it as blood money and would do anything they possibly could to turn back time and never have signed that lease. About 2 years ago, after our daughter was born, sorry, I'm just checking the time to make sure I'm up. Okay. my husband and I decided to purchase my grandmother's farm where this well is located because we have a winery which we actually rent a warehouse space for, and we wanted to expand our acreage and have our own place, and we also like the idea of raising our children in the area where we grew up and being close to our families who both live in the area. At that time, we believed what Fortuna had told us, which was that the Trenton Black River well was going to be over in a couple of years, and you would really never know the well was there because there was just going to be a small fenced-in area with a little green thing in the middle of the field, and they would reclaim the fields. The summer that we first moved to the farm, which was this past summer, I think was a bellwether. we didn't know it at the time, but... One of the first things that we became aware of was the well had diminished in pressure, and I just want to clarify something about what Chris was talking about before. Horizontal drilling is not new technology. Our well was a horizontal well, and it was a mile long. They drilled a mile deep and a mile long. The difference with Marcellus is that it's unconventional gas. And the well on my parents' property at Trenton Black River Well is in limestone, and it's conventional. And that means the gas is free. They do not have to hydrofrack it. They drill a hole, and the gas is under pressure, and it just comes out of the ground. This spring, the pressure was not as high as they needed it to be to hook into the national pipeline grid. And so they brought in some compressors. And these compressors are very similar to the compressors that Chris was talking about. The well is about 1,500 feet from our house, and for the first 3 months, we lived with it. You would notice it. It sounded like there was a big rig idling in our yard day and night. But we work all day and we're exhausted at night. But I think as time wore on, it started to really, really start to grate. And by the middle of the summer, we had to turn the fan on in our bedroom because we needed to drown out the noise. It was difficult to sleep. And I think I realized at that point that we hadn't heard the crickets all summer long, which is just something you kind of associate with living in the country and opening your window at night. Another thing that was happening this summer was that the Millennium Pipeline was being built. And I don't know if any of you live near the Millennium Pipeline. But it runs south of here, not too far, and I believe that there's also a branch of it that runs up north to the gas storage area in Tuma Lakes. So our road was on the way to the staging grounds for the Millennium Pipeline, and it's a narrow macadam road. And usually on our road, a car goes by maybe once every hour, except, in the morning when people go to work and come home in the evening. And during the summer, there were times when there was a truck every 3 minutes. It was a constant parade of dump trucks hauling gravel and coming back and going to the gravel pit. Busloads full of workers from out of state, trucks carrying the pieces of pipeline, every type of service vehicle you can imagine, trailers pulling bulldozers. It was relentless. And Our house was covered in dust. It was noisy. It was dangerous for our children, our child, and our animals. One time I was driving my tractor down the road, and I was literally, literally driven into the ditch by a rig driver who was either on speed or just a jerk. And interestingly, when they did turn the compressor off, because they put a compressor station on the Millennium Pipeline and that was now sucking the well, the silence was deafening. Anyway, it's basically, I started to listen to some rumbling murmurs about Marcellus at this point when I was getting so sort of aggravated about the impacts that the gas development was having on my life. And I think when I started to listen, what really struck me initially was that the Marcellus wells are long-lived wells. And what we'd always been told by the gas companies is, you know, we're going to get in here, we're going to get the gas, and we're going to be gone, and you're going to get a royalty check, we're going to clean up, and you're going to have your farm back. And basically, what I began to realize is that the farm was sold. And anybody who's leased and becomes held in production, which is what happens when any type of development happens and you're in a unit, you're held by production. And besides the Marcellus, there's seven other layers of shale. So what I realized is this is going to be happening for the rest of my life. Additionally, what really got me was with the Trenton Black River, there are graybins, and they run in little streaks. And if you go to the DEC website, you can see where the Trenton Black River wells are, and there's probably about maybe 10 or 15 in our town, in the neighboring town. And there'll be a graybin with, you know, four or five wells that each well is associated with 640 acres, and then there'll be a big space, and then there'll be another one. With the Marcellus shale, it runs under this entire region. And when I heard that the spacing units for Marcellus shale had been reduced to 40 acres, I realized they could put six wells on our property alone and 1,500 in our town. So that got me more interested and more active. One of the things that Chris was talking about, and I think this has really worked to the gas company's advantage, is this is a really divisive issue. People who want to utilize their land, you know, to earn some income, feel attacked by environmentalists who don't need to do those things. The gas companies have played up every division among everybody in our community. If somebody didn't want to sign, they would tell them that they had told their neighbors that they didn't sign and were holding up the lease. Literally. People felt afraid. People felt angry at each other. And that was one of the biggest impacts I saw in our community, was the divisions in people who normally live together like neighbors. So I also believed, because of my own personal, my family's sort of experiences with gas drilling, that surprisingly, the majority of the people who live in this area care about their water. The majority of the people do not want to sell their watershed to multinational energy corporations at any price. The majority of the people who have signed leases understood it to be, it's just free money. There was no information other than what the Farm Bureau and Cornell Cooperative Extension was presenting for landowners when we were faced with signing a lease. And everything that those agencies told us, those agencies that we trusted and looked to, said, this is great. This is good for farmers. This is good for people who care about the land.